CS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Joining us on the show today is Jim Rickards. He's a New York Times bestselling author of numerous books. He spent over 35 years in investment banking, political and national intelligence advisory roles, while also serving as a facilitator of the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. James, thanks for joining us on the show today.
It's great to be with you, Chris.
So, Jim, a recurring theme in a lot of your books, and I want to plug that if any of our listeners have not read any of your books, there's a large number of them that they can access, but a recurring theme through a lot of them is complexity theory. And this is something that you are an expert on, especially when we think about how complex the financial system is and how it operates. And right now, of course, we're seeing the spread of the coronavirus, the shock that it's having on the global supply chain, and the market reaction. Maybe we could start there and explain how complexity theory informs us of what's taking place right now.
The thing with complexity theory, is it informative? Is it helpful? Is it a good tool? The answer is absolutely yes, but it's more than that. Maybe I'll just take a minute and explain. For over 1,000 years, from the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, people believed that the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets all revolved around the Earth. The Earth was the center of the universe, and that those orbits were circular, and you know, some were further away than others. The stars were furthest of all, but they had this whole cosmology called the geocentric theory of the Earth being the center of the universe. And they weren't ignorant. They weren't superstitious. You could look at the sun. It comes up over in the east in the morning, goes down in the west in the evening, and pretty clearly it's circling around the Earth. And they worked out the mathematics of this, and the mathematics were quite complicated. And again, these were, you know, it's not like people were dopes in the 12th century. You had some pretty smart scholars. But as time went on, the observation instruments and the empirics got better, meaning the ability to kind of actually observe and make notes and, you know, through telescope and better applied mathematics, et cetera. And certain astronomers started to notice that the planets weren't exactly where the models predicted they should be. Like, you know, Jupiter's there, but it should be over here a little bit. And they didn't throw the theory out right away. They started to adapt it. And they had the cycles, you know, where the big revolutions around the Earth, but then they started coming up with epicycles. They're like, well, they're big circles, but they're little circles on the big circles, little curly cues, and that explains the apparent anomaly, and kind of on and on and on. It got more and more complicated. And when an anomaly shows up in your theory, you're supposed to question the theory. But what people often do is they justify the anomaly, say, well, here's an explanation for that, et cetera. So then along comes Copernicus in the early 16th century and says, well, wait a second. What if the Earth is not the center of the universe? What if the Earth actually revolves around the sun? And Johannes Kepler and Tycho Brahe came along with better observations and more advanced mathematics. And they said, yeah, not only that, but what if those orbits are not circular, they're elliptical. And then the elliptical orbits start to explain some of the observations. Even planets seem to be going backwards at times, but they weren't really going backwards. They were just out at a certain point of the elliptical orbit at a time when the Earth was moving away from it. So by the 17th century, the whole thing had fallen down. And the new cosmology, what we use today, basically came into being. They said, yeah, the sun's the center of the solar system, the universe, that's a separate issue, and the Earth revolves around the sun, the orbits are elliptical. Well, that change, that's not just an updated theory, that's not just accounting for anomalies, that's what's called a paradigm shift, a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of thinking about the solar system came into being. And it didn't happen overnight. Some of the discoveries happened quickly, but the adoption, the change in belief took 100 years. It's not like people said, you know, to Copernicus, hey, Nick, great idea, I got it. No, they fought him and ridiculed him, and it took 100 years. So now come forward now to the late 20th, early 21st century. The same thing is going on in finance. So what is the geocentric theory of finance, if I can call it that, the prevailing wisdom? Well, it has four or five pillars. One is that you know, markets are efficient. The idea that markets quickly incorporate new information. You can't beat the market because you can't get that information faster than the market itself. You know, unless you have inside information, that's different. But you can't get the information faster. You can't incorporate it faster. Markets are efficient. the distribution of risk. So we all know there are good days and bad days, market up, market down. But most of the observations cluster very close to small changes, and then there are a very small number of large changes, and it's what's called a normal distribution. That's the bell curve, which does apply to intelligence and height and a few other things, but the people have applied it to markets as well. Prices move smoothly from one level to another. Yes, they move around, but plenty of liquidity, plenty of chances to get in and out, you know, et cetera. These are and you can't beat the markets, basically. So these are the pillars of modern financial theory. Every one of them is wrong. Everything I just said is wrong. Markets are not efficient. At times they're bizarre. They're crazy. They are what they are. You know, the old saying, you can't fight the market. But if you look at the expectation of a Fed rate cut before April at the end of January, so what was the market expecting in terms of an April rate cut at the end of January? The answer is it was given about a 28% probability. I was one of the ones, along with a few others, but not many, who were saying, no, the Fed's definitely going to cut. But the market gave it a 28% probability. Once the impact of coronavirus was assessed, and you know, the people saw the Chinese economy imploding, that went to 100%. And of course, sure enough, the Fed cut rates early the other day, 50 basis points, and probably cut them again in March. But my point is, there was nothing efficient about the market expectation in late January. It was way, way off the mark, but that's how markets work. Prices don't move smoothly and continuously. They gap up, they gap down. Markets are irrational. Risk is not normally distributed. It's distributed in accordance with what's called a power curve, which means that the extreme events happen far more frequently than a normal distribution would predict, and so on. My point is, when you take all these things into account, the way we've had a paradigm shift in understanding how capital markets work, it's equivalent in its own way to saying, no, the sun doesn't revolve around the earth revolves around the sun. Here's the problem. Wall Street has not adjusted. Wall Street still thinks the sun revolves around the earth. Complexity theory is not new. It's relatively new in the history of science, but the Big Bang was an example of a complex dynamic system at work. So the dynamics of complexity theory have been around since the beginning of time, but the formal theory, mathematics behind it, really developed around 1960. And they've been applied successfully to a lot of things, seismology, volcanology, meteorology, branches of physics, et cetera. But when you look at the principles of complexity theory and you look at the behavior of capital markets, you have to know both. You have to be a little bit of a physicist and a capital markets expert at the same time. What you can see, and this is empirical, this is not a guess, that you can actually demonstrate this, that capital markets are complex dynamic systems, but Wall Street still treats them as if they were efficient and normally distributed. So this creates all kinds of opportunities for investors, because if you're using complexity theory, your ability to do predictive analytics, your ability to say what's going to happen next is much, much greater, much more accurate than the typical Wall Street analysts who are still using these out-of-date concepts. So I didn't invent complexity theory, but I am one of the pioneers, not the only one, but one of a relatively small number who are bringing it into capital markets and using it as a tool to get much better, predictive analytics on capital markets. And it has properties that are consistent with complexity theory. One is that these extreme events happen much more frequently than a normal distribution would predict. They don't happen every, 3 billion years, the way Jamie Dimon describes it. They actually happen every 7 to 10 years. And there are what people call black swans. I don't like the expression black swan because, it's an interesting piece of natural history and a very successful book for Nassim Taleb, credit to him. But it kind of throws up your hands using a zoological metaphor. What physicists say, use the expression emergent properties and phase transitions. Emergent property is something that seems to come out of nowhere. Basically, the property is not something you can derive from perfect knowledge of the contents of the system, and yet it happens anyway, the way an earthquake does. I mean, people understand earthquakes, but they absolutely cannot predict them. That you can say it's more likely than not on a fault line, that's fine, but is it next year or 100 years from now? They have no way to predict that, but they happen. And so ideas like emergent properties, things that seem to come out of nowhere, phase transitions where, we've seen one recently in the stock markets where we went from new all-time highs to losing 1,000 points a day. That's significant, but that comes as no surprise to a complexity theorist. So I do talk about this in my books, Chapter 10 of Currency Wars. Has a long explanation of it. And you're right, I've used it in all of my books, chapter 3 of The Road to Ruin and my new book, Aftermath, all make some reference to complexity theory. But there's a reason for that, which is it's the best way to understand behavior in capital markets.
In relation to what we see right now with the markets, I mean, we're seeing the stock market up or down almost every day by hundreds, if not thousands of points. And there's a lot of unknowns. As you mentioned, financial markets are these complex dynamic systems. They exhibit nonlinear behavior. And one big reason for that is that there is a limit to how much we can see into the future. There's human psychology involved, and the complexity of a network itself exhibits feedback loops and all sorts of interesting properties, which you know you covered and you discuss in your books. But let's talk about the coronavirus and its spread a little bit. We just had the pleasure of speaking with Robert Shiller on his book, Narrative Economics, How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events. And what he describes is how the mathematical models underpinning epidemiology and the spread of infectious disease map directly onto the way in which narratives spread throughout society and drive economic events. I think this is a very fascinating visual illustration of this right now. But what are your thoughts about the coronavirus and the impact that this is having on the market?
Well, first of all, I agree with your description. And the thing about epidemiology, which is, you know, the science of the spread of infectious diseases, that is a complex dynamic system. You're absolutely right about that. But what's interesting, so if epidemiology is a complex dynamic system, the spread of disease is a complex dynamic system, and if capital markets are a complex dynamic system, which they are, first of all, one should have something to teach us about the other. And number two, it should come as no surprise that they crash into each other and interact, because that's how networks work. Now, it's interesting that the mathematics and the model behind the spread of disease is identical to the models I use in assessing capital markets and risking capital markets. Again, it's not a surprise. It's not a metaphor. Yeah, you can describe it as a metaphor, but it's the same math. It's the same phenomena. There's a reason when you hear, you know, central bankers and IMF heads and CEOs of big banks, whenever there's a financial panic going on, and you know, we're kind of coming close to one right now, but we certainly had one in 2008, and we had what looked like the beginning of one in September 2019 with what was going on in the repo markets, although that seems to be happening again. You'll hear the word contagion. You know, the CEO of a big bank will say, well, we're worried about contagion, or the head of some central bank or the director of research will say, we're worried about contagion in the markets. Well, that's interesting. Why are they using the word contagion? That comes from disease. Well, the answer is it's the same dynamic systems in operation. So what's the main contagion model? Well, epidemiologists use something called the SEIR model, S-E-I-R. S for susceptible, E for exposed, I for infected, R for recovered. So they say, well, are you susceptible to the disease? Number one. Number two, have you been exposed? It doesn't matter if you're susceptible if you're not exposed, but if you are susceptible and exposed, now there's some risk, now there's some danger. I, are you infected? Did you get it? And have you recovered? And of course, the flip side of that is if you get it and you don't recover, you're dead, you're a fatality. And so they can apply mathematical values to all of those. And what percentage of the population is susceptible? Are you exposed? So that's a kind of a geographic function. Are you close? And that's why quarantine is such a powerful tool. If you quarantine the people who have it, then no one else in theory gets exposed. That's not perfect, but that's one of the things you go for. And then are you infected? Well, not everyone gets infected, but there's a function to describe that. And then what's the recovery rate? Or that's kind of the inverse of what's the fatality rate? Not every disease has the same factors, but the model works extremely well. You might have to change the factors based on the evidence you gather, and we're in that stage with coronavirus right now. Well, bring it over to the banking system. You know, susceptible. Well, are you strongly capitalized or thinly capitalized? That makes you more or less susceptible to a financial run. Are you exposed? Well, if your market is the one that's imploding, or you're a heavy mortgage lender and the mortgage market is melting down, or you're a heavy junk bond investor and the junk bond market is melting down, well, now you're exposed. Infected, do you actually get a run on the bank? Do you end up in a Bear Stearns situation? And recovery, some banks muddle through, other banks get bailed out, but some don't. You have some fatalities like Lehman Brothers. So that whole model, you know, susceptible, exposed, infected, recovered, applies very well to capital markets and financial services. So it should not be surprising that the dynamics are the same, the math is the same. And your way of understanding it, you know, when you say somebody's too big to fail, Well, what is that? Well, that's a quarantine. You know, the central banks are putting you in quarantine. We're separating you from the infected, saying, you know, if you're too big to fail, you've got a vaccine, if you want to think of it that way. So these, as I say, the model between epidemiology and financial contagion is more than a metaphor. The math is the same. The dynamics are the same. One has a lot to teach the other. Now, what we're seeing is one complex dynamic system crashing into another. And I can think of no better example of this than March 2011, Fukushima in Japan. Well, what happened there? Well, it started out as an undersea earthquake. There was an earthquake on the bottom of the sea. Tectonic plates and seismic activity, that's a good example of a complex dynamic system. But then that earthquake caused a tsunami. Well, a tsunami is a different complex dynamic system. Now you're into hydrodynamics. So here comes the tsunami or the tidal wave. And what does it crash into? It crashes into a nuclear power plant. Well, that's another complex dynamic system. I mean, anyone who knows anything about how nuclear power plants work with neutron rods and how you can dial it up or dial it down, you know, on a very nuanced, fine-tuned basis to basically boil water and run a turbine. But if any of those systems fail or gets out of control, you can have a meltdown situation, which is what started to happen. And then what happened next? The Tokyo stock market crashed. Well, again, capital markets are a complex dynamic system. So you had four complex dynamic systems, right? Tectonic plates, hydrodynamics, nuclear radiation, and capital markets, and they crashed into each other. The earthquake caused the tsunami, which caused the meltdown, which caused the stock market crash. Again, not unusual. So we're seeing that right now, which is coronavirus is causing a major economic slowdown, which is causing markets to crash. Are we at the bottom? My view is no. They made a big adjustment. They seem to have bounced back based on some political news. Well, that's another interesting thing, which is we have stock markets are being affected by economic growth or decline, which is affected by coronavirus outbreak, but they're also impacted by political developments. My point being, yes, these are all complex systems. It's the best way to understand what's going on. Standard macroeconomic models don't work. Standard capital markets risk management models don't work. It's not because the people who design them are dumb, or it's not because they don't know how to do math. It's because they have the wrong paradigm, going back to Copernicus. If your way of thinking about the world doesn't line up with reality, then all the math won't help you, because you're modeling the wrong thing, or you're modeling a wrong understanding. So you've got to get the understanding right. Then you can proceed from there to come up with some models that actually work. But we're seeing multiple complex dynamic systems, namely the coronavirus, the economy, and capital markets all interact with each other. And at least between the economy and capital markets, yes, there is a feedback loop. I don't think the virus cares very much about what the Fed does, but the Fed cutting rates does, you know, theory provides some stimulus, although the market sort of said, call us if you have a vaccine, but until then, your rate cuts are not going to stop the disease, and that's not going to stop the economic slowdown.
Well, Jim, I know that your time is limited, and it was a pleasure to have you on our program. Any lasting thoughts for our audience in terms of what we discussed today, or how they can follow more of your work?
Well, thank you. My most recent book is called Aftermath. It's obviously available on Amazon and good bookstores. It's interesting. I had a book in 2016 called The New Case for Gold. It was a bestseller at the time, still in print, but that's actually selling very well, obviously partly because of what gold's doing. So that book's having a little bit of a revival. But Aftermath and The New Case for Gold are both out there from Amazon and in bookstores. Thank you.
All right, Jim. Well, it was a pleasure. We look forward to speaking with you again. And I do want to recommend that all of our listeners go out and read both of those books in addition to many of the others. They are must-read books for sure.
Thanks, Chris.
So once again, that was Jim Rickards. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's spent over 35 years in investment banking, political and national intelligence advisory roles. He's an advisor on international economics and financial threats to the Department of Defense and the U.S. intelligence community, and served as a facilitator of the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. And he talks about that at length in his book, The Currency Wars, and touches upon it as well in a number of his other books, including his most recent, titled Aftermath. If you have any questions about what we discussed today, please feel free to email me at cris@financialsense.com. Or if you'd like to get a hold of Financial Sense Wealth Management to discuss any of our investment services, how we are currently positioned, you can always contact us at financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
The The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.